This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. And in this programme, we find out how well-heeled you need to be to afford Napoleon's boots. We sample Tasmania and marvel at comics and their prices. We find the key to what makes typewriters valuable and fish around the review of a book on codpieces. Then there's the big question, what is art? Even if you don't know, by the end of the programme, you may be clearer as to what you think it isn't. And you may get a chuckle along the way, a column 8-style Sydney Morning Herald humour. Stay tuned to be entertained, amused, challenged. And remember, art is a three-letter word. But before we begin, let's get a little clarification. I often mention buyer's premium when I'm reading about the prices items have sold for. That's partly because it's in the text, but also because buyer's premium is added to the hammer price of something that's sold. Typically, it's about 20 to 25% on top of the hammer price. The English-published Antique Trade Gazette puts out a glossary of terms, which we've referred to before in previous programmes, and this is how it describes the buyer's premium. A charge made by the auctioneer to the buyer as a percentage of the hammer price. This fee is usually subject to VAT. Incidentally, VAT would be our Australian GST. So let's kick off with those boots. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 14th of December on page 8. Napoleon's boots ride into auction. Leather riding boots owned by Napoleon and made by his regular bootmaker, Jacques, who was based on the Rue Montmartre in Paris, sold for 91,000 euros. That's 77,780 pounds, plus buyer's premium, at the Drouot Auctions Centre on November the 29th. Incidentally, that's close to 200,000 Australian dollars. Boots were worn by him during his exile on the island of St. Helena. They were lent by one of the emperor's comrades, General Bertrand, to the sculptor Carlo Marocchetti, 1805 to 1867, who was working on an equestrian statue of Napoleon. The sculptor's son, the Baron Marocchetti, gave them to Senator Paul Leroux, in whose family they had remained until they were consigned to auction at Binoche et Giquello, with an estimate of 50 to 80,000 euros. And that's a lot less, incidentally, than the 91,000 euros they fetched. That was before buyer's premium was added, of course. One of the joys of art and antiques is the history, and these physical objects put us in touch with a slightly intangible past that we have. And just such a thing has happened with Napoleon's boots, because that sale report was followed up by a letter to the editor of the Antiques Trade Gazette, which was published on the 4th of January 2019 on page 55. And Mr. Graham Bowers from Newport on the Isle of Wight gives us the following further information about Napoleon and his boots. Napoleon grounded on St. Helena. Madam, the report on the sale of a pair of riding boots formerly owned by the Emperor Napoleon during his captivity on St. Helena brings to mind a number of points. First, that they would not have seen much use for the last third of the Emperor's detention. This was because Napoleon refused to ride out under the conditions imposed on his exercise by the island's governor, Sir Hudson Lowe. Napoleon was forbidden to engage in conversation with anyone he met or to enter any private residence. He would have to be accompanied by a military escort. This, of course, the Emperor could not accede to. So, despite encouragement from both his retinue and the British to ride for his health's sake, neither he nor the governor would back down. It does not surprise me that they left St. Helena in the hands of the Count Bertrand, as he made off with anything that was not nailed down, and one or two things that were. Were they worth the 91,000 euros paid? For all that history? Oh yes, every penny. Thank you, Mr. Graham Bowers, for that fascinating piece of history, which certainly adds a lot of interest to Napoleon's boots, but it also raises the important question of provenance. You do have to be certain that the boots really did belong to Napoleon if you're going to pay quite such a lot of money, nearly 200,000 Australian dollars. I think in this case it's a very safe bet that they most certainly did. Let's now move to the Southern Hemisphere and Van Diemen's Land, and let's sample something very different. Another piece of history, of course. What is a sampler? It's not a little bottle in a brown paper bag accompanying you on your way to the doctor's surgery. In fact, it's a piece of embroidery to show a girl's needlework skills, usually pictorial, with the alphabet and a short piece of text. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 7th of December. Positive thoughts in the bleak Van Diemen's Land. This rare sampler, which is pictured, which is just 6 inches, that's 15 centimetres across, was completed by a girl from the Queen's Orphan School in Van Diemen's Land, the Isle of Tasmania, in 1838. The orphanage was established in 1833 to house orphans' neglected children and the children of convicts transported from Europe to the horrors of a penal colony. It was described in a newspaper article at the time as cold and comfortless. The writer goes on to elaborate, "Never did we see 200 human beings that exhibited so squalid an appearance as did the majority of the Queen's orphans." Belying such a bleak situation is the colourful and carefully stitched sampler executed on a fine hemmed gauze, which contains a verse, "Lines of a lady, extolling the virtues of meekness and mildness, and wishing, may she in paths of flowers stray." The name Van Diemen's Land was changed to Tasmania in 1856 in honour of the Dutch explorer Abel Tasman, who was the first European to land on its shores in 1642. The sampler is evidently the same date as a basket made up of similar embroidered panels that was presented to Lady Jane Franklin, wife of Lieutenant Governor Sir John Franklin. It's now owned by the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery. The sampler carried an estimate of £600 to £800 at Tennant's Costume, Accessories and Textiles sale in Leyburn on November the 22nd. It met with multiple bidders before selling at £9,200 plus 24% buyer's premium. Needlework was seen as a way of importing a work ethic and self-discipline. And so says Roland Arkell in the Antique Trade Gazette of the 7th of December. And let's marvel now at some truly comical prices. How many of you remember Marvel comics? I was a Beano and Dandy boy, and sometimes ventured into Topper. Anyway, here's a piece from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 7th of December. Marvel comics sets a world record price. A 1939 copy of Marvel Comics, number 1, offered at heritage auctions, set a world record for the most expensive Marvel comic ever sold. On November the 21st in Dallas, it took a $1.05 million, that's 814,000 English pound, hammer price. And that is $1.26 million American dollars, including the 20% buyer's premium, which is also a house record for a comic book at Heritage. It was first bought from a newsstand rack by a postman in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, who purchased every number one issue he could of both comic books and magazines beginning in the 1940s. The comic was graded 9.4 on a scale of 1 to 10, making it the best condition ever found, according to the Certified Guarantee Company. And that certainly is an expensive comic, coming in at close to 2 million Australian dollars, which would use up most young lads' pocket money for quite a few years. Now, today's equivalent of Marvel Comics, or Beano, or Dandy, are produced on computers. But not in the old days. Let's hear about some original methods of creation. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette on the 7th of December. typewriters take key role for collectors. Invented in the 19th century but are outmoded by word processors then computers, typewriters are now having a resurgence in the collecting world. Vintage restored working typewriters from the 1910 to 1970 period are now sold online, for example, priced from £125 to £400. Fairwise, try Frome Independent Market in Somerset, where Julie and Philip Chapman of Charlie Foxtrot are among the traders. Philip said, "There's been a worldwide resurgence in interest in manual typewriters for a few years now. The more digital everyone goes, the more demand there is for a small section of people to do this the old analog way. We sell our manual, mainly portable typewriters, with ribbons made to our own specifications, to collectors and creative writers, and people wanting to avoid computers due to security concerns and the complexity of always having to keep up with technology, and parents buying for their children to get them off computers. The brands we like to source are Olivetti, Imperial, Remington, Corona, and Hermes, due to their superior engineering and quality of design. The Chapmans sell worldwide, sourcing their stock from fairs and auctions and from people who contact them. As to their typewriters of choice, Philip adds, Julie likes Olympia and I like an Imperial Good Companion number 1, and we both like Hermes 2000s and 3000s. The Chapman's firm began down under in 2012 at Kirribilli Market, just next to Sydney Harbour Bridge. They returned to Wiltshire in 2017. Now, some of these prices can be a bit confusing. And here's another tip for those who want to find out what sells and how much for, and where to find out. This piece comes from John Furphy of Carter's Publications, who writes, Carter's Publications have been publishing price guides on art, antiquities, antiques, collectibles, retro, vintage, and 20th century since 1985, and include prices on items from 1500 BC to the present day, with a price range of $5 to over $1 million. The last printed Carter's Price Guide to Antiques and Collectibles was produced in 2010, and from that year, Carter's moved to digital publishing on the internet. The online version of the price guide, available at www.carters.com.au, with over 400,000 items covering actual sales results over the last 10 years, offers over 25 times as many items as included in one of their printed price guides. To keep the online price guide current and relevant, they're constantly adding fresh items and removing the older items. In addition, this online version of Carter's Price Guides to Antiques and Collectibles is now fully indexed to enable visitors to quickly locate the type of items you're seeking prices on. You can search by category, subcategory, or searched keywords with the facility to further refine your search, making it easier to drill down to the item you're seeking. All antiques and collectibles in this database include a professionally photographed image and have been sourced from actual auction sales in Australia and New Zealand. Carter's Price Guide is based on actual selling prices. Remember that prices of antiques and collectibles can vary considerably depending on a multitude of factors. The listing displays the actual auction sale price at auction. So, for more information, go to www.carters.com.au. Carters being spelt C-A-R-T-E-R-S. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. And now for something completely different. Here's a fishy story. If you thought a codpiece was what you get wrapped up in newspaper with your chips, you'd be very wrong. Codpieces wrap something very different, and there's a book to tell us all about it. Let's review the situation. And the book is by Michael Glover. It's called Thrust, A Spasmodic Pictorial History of the Codpiece in Art. And it's by David Zwirner Books, and it comes in at $12.95, presumably American. And we're reading from the Art Newspaper of December 2019. As the art critic Michael Glover writes in this entertaining slim volume, the codpiece was defined in Captain Francis Gross's 18th century tome, Classical Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue, as the foreflap of a man's breeches. Originally intended to bridge the drafty and revealing gap between two individual stockings, the codpiece, Glover writes, grew into a garment that drew attention to, mimicked, and even aggrandized the male genitals to a ridiculous degree. He then takes us on a marvellous journey through portraits, including works by Titian, Holbein, Parmigianino, in which the codpiece is a protagonist. Because of the codpiece's relatively ahem brief prominence in male dress, little more than half a century, Glover suggests time has been unkind to some of the portraits, not least Giovanni Battista Moroni's portrait of Antonio Navagero of 1565, which is pictured. He was the chief magistrate of Bergamo, but the serious-mindedness that Moroni sought is undermined by what Glover describes as the clownishly extravagant, curly-whirly, whooping-it-up prosthesis in Navagero's groin. Glover's book is published just ahead of the festive season, which is appropriate. It's an ideal stocking filler. And that review was by Ben Luke in the Art Newspaper. And after that little bit of information, you may wish to change your order in the fish and chip shop to haddock and chips. And if that's your main course, you may want to have a banana for dessert. And we're going to have bananas now under the question of what is art? Well, perhaps this will help you to decide. If not, it'll give you an insight into grocery bills and Australian humour. This piece comes from the Sydney Morning Herald of the 11th of December on pages 12 and 13, but was reprinted from the Washington Post. And it has a picture of a gentleman eating a banana. And the headline is, "What qualifies as art is now judged at the hand of the auctioneers," writes Sebastian Smee. Bananas? Sure. Worth $175,000? Why not? To buy a banana taped to a wall for $120,000, that's $175,591, is, believe it or not, a perfectly rational decision. If it's presented as an artwork by a famous artist with a strong track record, and especially if it becomes notorious, which is what happened at warp speed last week to Maurizio Cattelan's Comedian, a banana taped to a wall in a gallery during the annual Art Basel in Miami, it will go up in value. It will be a good investment. That's just how it works. Am I saying it's not crazy? Of course not. It's bonkers. But what's not crazy? Have you been to an art fair? There are revolting spectacles. Imagination and talent brutally transformed into naked commerce. Are you aware of what's going on in the wider world? Did you know a reality TV host is President of the United States? The key to it all, as always, was the media attention. Comedian quickly went viral. It was the subject of wry comments on MSNBC by Chuck Todd, who argued quite reasonably that a world where people can pay $120,000 for a banana taped to a wall is a world where income inequality is out of hand. How many artists get this kind of exposure? $120,000 for a piece produced in an edition of three, all have sold, will probably turn out to be a bargain. What Happened to Comedian After It Became a Media Sensation sums up your collective disorder exquisitely. First, at lunchtime on Saturday, David Datuna, a little-known and well-fed-looking performance artist wanting to become better known, showed up at the gallery, took the banana off the wall, and claiming to be a hungry artist, ate it. The banana was promptly replaced. No problem. Comedian, like Damien Hirst's Dead Shark, Sol LeWitt's wall drawings, and thousands of other works of conceptual art, is about the idea, which in this case, ironically, is that the art market is insane, not the fruit per se. It comes with an authentication certificate and instructions to the owner to replace the banana every 10 days. But the crowds at the exhibit had gotten out of hand and posed a serious health and safety risk, as well as an access issue, according to the gallery. So by Sunday, the final day of Art Basel, Comedian had been taken down. Then, perhaps craziest of all, but who's measuring, hours before the fair closed, Roderick Weber, a 46-year-old artist and aspiring politician from Massachusetts, scrawled, "Epstein didn't kill himself," in red lipstick on the wall where the banana had been. This was, of course, a reference to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, who died in prison in August. Weber recently attempted to register for New Hampshire presidential primary under the name Epstein Didn't Kill Himself. If you're angry with Maurizio Catalan for causing all this, you may have good reason, but I'm inclined to think you have the wrong man. Catalan pokes fun at the art market himself and our society in general. He's smart and he can be very funny. That said, as a provocation and as a work of art, the banana is relatively weak. Much more intense and provocative was the time Catalan taped his own dealer, the Italian Massimo De Carlo, to the wall of his gallery. Comedian is clearly intended as a reprise of this earlier piece, which, needless to say, required a lot more duct tape. For an art dealer, a more pointed humiliation is hard to imagine. And yet it was gleefully agreed to because it was, in the economy of the art market, it made sense. Everyone profited from it. What is to blame? Art? That people have a sense of humour? Income equality, as Chuck Todd seems to think? Sure, if you say so. And yet this kind of grouping for scapegoats is facile. If you're Todd, why not be honest about what's going on? Why not apportion blame to the whole media and social media economy, which revolves around an intense fight for people's attention and runs on advertising that manufactures desire? And that came from the Washington Post, originally. So, what do Australians think of this? The inimitable column 8 of the Sydney Morning Herald enlightens us. On page 25, Monday the 16th of December. "There is no banana duct tape to my wall," writes Anne Cook of Ermington, "but there is a floor-to-ceiling window in the living room where a bird species, unknown, left a large deposit. The exterior of these windows are cleaned annually, last in September, and if it doesn't rain before I have visitors over the Christmas period, I'll be framing it and calling it art. But what movement?" Thank you, Column 8. Yes, indeed. What movement? Baroque? Renaissance? Pre-Raphaelite? Well, we do have some further information on that, again in Column 8, and we only have to turn to Thursday the 19th of December for a little bit more on the topic. What movement for the bird's artistry? Why, it's the bowel movement, of course, says David Gordon of Cranebrook. Regina Brewster of Robertson says the local wombats are equally creative. And let's move now to something more firmly rooted in the soil. And this has considerable historical interest. And this item comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 4th of January. Something for the new year. Ring sheds light on Jewish soldiers in Roman army. A Roman bronze ring offered for sale by Pax Romana, 15% buyer's premium, in London on November the 24th appears to shed light on a little-known aspect of the Imperial Army, the contribution of Jewish soldiers. to the bezel is the Star of David, while the shoulders are inscribed Ves Pass for the Emperor Vespasian, who ruled from 69 to 79, and Legio V11, that's the 7th Legion. Evidence suggests that Jews served in the imperial army from the beginning of the Pax Romana under Augustus, 27 BC to 14 AD, to the ascent of Christianity in the 5th century. The first Jewish revolt, 66 to 70, itself, including the Roman army's capture of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, was thwarted by the aid of Tiberius Julius Alexander, an Alexandrian Jew who, as prefect of Egypt, employed his legions in Judea. Many other Jews were hired as foot soldiers, leaving inscriptions or symbols on their tombstones and sarcophagi. This ring, described by the auction house as unique, came for sale from a private collection in London that had been formed in the 1970s on the UK and European art market. It was estimated at just £500 to £700, but found plenty of admirers before the gavel fell at £22,000. And let's go back to the beginning of the programme, where we talked about buyer's premium. On top of that hammer price of £22,000 must be added the 15% buyer's premium we mentioned, which takes the price up to £25,300 altogether, which is what the buyer must pay to take the item away from the auction house. And that, in Australian terms, is approximately $50,000. And how things move around the world. Here's a little piece from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 14th of December. Battle scene panels beat estimate. Consigned from a scholarly collector in New Zealand, a pair of relief-carved ivory panels was among the highlights of Fonzie Mealy, 22% buyer's premium including VAT, Castle Comer sale on November the 26th. The vendor believed they were early 18th century and could be attributed to the Venetian ivory carver Antonio Leoni. Similar panels depicting ancient battle scenes and Germanic soldiers were executed circa 1710 when Leoni worked at the Dusseldorf court of Johann William II of the Palatinate, 1690 to 1716. Similar work in the Baroque taste was much reproduced by French carvers in the 19th century. Each measuring 13 inches, that's 33 centimetres wide, the panels were estimated at 4,000 to 6,000 euros for the County Kilkenny auction in Ireland and sold to a UK collector at 15,000 euros, that's £12,750. And that was an item that travelled from New Zealand to England and to Ireland. A well-travelled piece indeed. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.